Next up is Jake Cohen, and Jake is currently a master's degree candidate at the University of Washington, where he is completing his thesis on the intersections of place and geographic theory with the symphonic work Men and Mountains, written by American ultramodern composer Carl Ruggles. His primary areas of interest outside the Grateful Dead are the American modernist composers of the early 20th century, including Charles Ives, Carl Ruggles, Aaron Copland, Henry Cowell, and others. Jake has been a deadhead ever since hearing the guitar riff from Terrapin Station wafting from his camp counselor stereo at age 13. In the summer of 1994.
Oh. Yeah. Give the kid a break.
He's gone on Fish Tour, Disco Biscuits Tour, and String Cheese Incident Tour, and managed to get to one Grateful Dead show, 9/29/94, at the Boston Garden.
We accept you, one of us.
And I'm wearing my Terrapin shirt as well, because the fact that Terrapin was kind of the catalyst for it all led me to choose this topic today. I was also prompted by Jay, who's not here this year, unfortunately. Or is he here?
Williams? Jay couldn't make it.
Okay. His request for me last year of saying, well, that was a great paper, but I wish you'd done something with music, actual music, since you have this training. And I said, oh, all right, I'll try doing that for next year. So my disclaimer here is that if I mention the word Terrapin at all, I am talking about the song Terrapin Station that we know from the live performances. So including the Lady with a Fan and the Terrapin Station sections that are on the original album, and concluding with the guitar solo that we all know and love. That made me get it, of course, 14 years ago. So in other words, what we're all familiar with from the show context.
So not at a siding.
Not at a siding, and not Kay's kind of metaphysical Terrapin idea as well. Just give
not
me a
turtle, right?
And not the actual turtle, yes. And actually,
or
just
the University of Maryland.
Yeah. Or the University of Maryland. Yes.
What about the one that holds up the
turtles?
The
turtles all the way down.
Hold on. And one second, because I just
Yertle
realized.
Didn't rhyme with Terrapin, so.
The Terrapin CD.
Oh, it's a great CD.
One second here. What, all this stuff? It isn't. Don't worry about it.
I'm still impressed.
There's nothing actually happening there, so.
Perhaps you should get a Mac.
Probably.
Right, that's enough of those.
Probably
jokes,
should happen, yes.
But it's always true.
It is.
Okay. Yes, I actually have to go this route here, so. Okay. Unfortunately, I have to go back and forth between my PowerPoint and something else that will be slightly instructive, but I think everybody will live. Oh, God. Okay, there we go, finally. So, Terrapin Station joins a short list of songs in the running for the Grateful Dead's magnum opus. It's a song which holds a deep spiritual meaning for both performer and audience member alike. Terrapin has achieved mythical status within the Grateful Dead's output. From its supernatural compositional history, to its mythologically invoking lyrical content, to its hypnotic and compelling guitar solo. The song has also been the subject of a number of scholarly presentations, examining both its existential and philosophical nature, as well as its musical structure and its context within performance. Lance Smith has examined the Greek Nikea and illustrated the many analogs between Terrapin and this mythic archetype. David Malviny has posited that Terrapin is not just an orchestrated composition in the traditional sense, but that it also invokes a postmodern performative aspect. Right, exactly.
The most revealing quote of this conference so far. Mark, you're going to have to explain that one.
That
for
was
us.
Good. But also that it invokes a postmodern performative aspect of orchestration. That is, the song actually orchestrates the remainder of the set. John Nye has also studied some of the postmodern implications of Terrapin and its exploration of the infinite and the universal. All of these studies show that Terrapin is not merely a song, but a transcendent musical entity that dips into a number of areas which, not surprisingly, are all connected to concepts of the supernatural, the universal, the mythological, and the metaphysical. My paper today will examine how a concept of place can be read alongside the harmonic structure of the song, and how this hybrid analysis ultimately points to the larger interconnectivity of Terrapin's geography and its musical structure. Whether consciously or not, the geography of Terrapin, its very place within the material, ontological, and epistemological worlds, informs the music of Terrapin. Of course, audience members without perfect pitch may not be able to hear the fact that Terrapin begins in a completely different key than the one it ends in, or that the harmonic and tonal centers of the piece are either ambiguously or weakly defined. Yet trust me, our ears do hear this, whether or not we are consciously aware of it, just as our ears hear the variety of harmonic centers in a Mozart symphony movement, for example. In its own way, Terrapin musically performs its place. That is, it presents to us a musical place that is inherently ambiguous and ephemeral. And for a song about a place, that's a pretty far-out set of directions for how to get there. The now often reproduced and quoted story about this song's genesis has become something of legend. I'll just briefly summarize, because I think many of us know it, that Robert Hunter was watching a lightning storm at the same time as Jerry Garcia was, and they both wrote their parts independently. Robert Hunter, the lyrics, Jerry, the music, came together the next day, and it all worked. From its start, it's clear in the lyrics that Terrapin Station is a place. The use of the word station invites hermeneutics not only of railways, but also the New Testament, where the many stations of Christ's journey to his death each represent a specific stopping place in Jerusalem. But what is the place of Terrapin? How is it presented to us? And perhaps most importantly, what is place? And let's begin with that basic problem of defining place, and it is certainly a problem. As geographer Tim Cresswell notes, the basic definitive predicament is that place is not a specialized piece of academic terminology. It is a word wrapped in common sense. Indeed, place has become such a frequently used word in the everyday lexicon that its meaning is taken for granted as a pre-assumed axiom. It would be unwise to make any generalizing statements about what place means at this point, or to examine the many differences between place and its close cousin, space. I will, however, offer one of many interpretations of this essential difference to highlight a point that I want to return to later. Edward S. Casey offers the traditional view that when broken down to their lowest common denominators, space is just empty, meaningless, vacuous, and becomes a place only when it is given a set of particular characteristics. So, for example, a name or an experienced anecdote, etc. Space is this abstract concept, whereas place is specific. And as a corollary to that, place is derived concretely from space. Casey also presents the reversed argument, the so-called Archytian axiom, that place is actually the progenitor of all things and that space follows from it. Ultimately, he deduces that place is a product of phenomenology, and therefore space and time are contained in places rather than places in them, because space and time only operate as we experience them within places. So in other words, we only have places because we are the people who are perceiving them, and the spaces only are derived from the places. Casey will be the first to admit that this reasoning is not necessarily an authoritative final statement on the issue of place and space, but his well-supported hypothesis presents one possible foray into the discussion. Sociologist Thomas Guerin provided a set of criterion by which to ground sociological examinations of place. His extensive literature review identifies three main characteristics of place, and although these are once again not authoritative, it will be useful to define place as such in my explanation today. The first is a geographic location. A place is a unique spot in the universe. It does not have to have a map coordinates to be a place, but it can be an imagined geographic location, or like your favorite armchair, or a seaside, or a more traditional geographic location like the corner of 4th Ave North and Newell in Seattle, Washington. That's where I live. The second prerequisite for place is investment with meaning and value. Places are interpreted, narrated, perceived, felt, understood, and imagined. It's instructive for my purposes to include the word performed in the list as well. And the third requirement for place is material form. Quote, place has physicality, or more bluntly, place is stuff. The first two are easy. Terrapin is a spot in the universe. Robert Hunter tells us as much. And we have certainly inscribed it with meaning. But what is the physical and material form of terrapin, or any music for that matter? The answer is that the music must become the physical and material form of the place. Whether we think of this as mimesis, mimicry, abstract representation, or literally as the sound waves becoming the place, the music is the key third element in determining the place of terrapin. And that musical representation of place is both musical and lyrical. So I'll begin with the words, a much more tangible element in this web of geographical reference. Hunter tells us that we, quote, get to terrapin, that it is, quote, in the shadow of the moon, and that, quote, will be there soon. Of course, the train imagery invoked immediately brings to mind a locomotive speeding towards this place, Terrapin Station, with the brakes on and its whistle screaming. However, Hunter never gives us these specific directions to this place. We don't even hear about this so-called Terrapin Station until nearly the end of the song, and before that, Hunter hints at terrapin, but not its identity as a station. Furthermore, the entire Lady with a Fan section of the song never even mentions terrapin. Instead, we get confused into thinking that maybe this song's place is somewhere very British-sounding called Carlisle. Now to the tougher part. How does the music of terrapin perform its place? Is it Lady with a Fan? Is it the transitional material? Which part of it is the performance of place? And I must digress at this point to discuss a few aspects of harmony that will be crucial to the rest of this paper, and I apologize to the musical people for the butchering I'm about to inscribe on this, and I apologize to the very non-musical people for the fact that I have to rush through this, and maybe you won't understand it when I get out of this, but I'm trying anyway, so. Yes. The terms tonal center or harmonic center or key area all relate to pretty much the same concept. Much music in the Western tradition for the last 300 years or so can be said to be in a key. This key dictates all the notes and all the chords that are available to use, which ones are more normal sounding to our ears, and which are outside the realm of that key, what we refer to as chromatic tones. Music in a key. There we go. Love technology. Music in a key, say arbitrarily the key of C major, uses mainly the notes of the C major scale. Make sure I got volume here. Okay. So we call these notes scale degrees, and we refer to them as 1 through 7, where of course 1 and 8 are the same thing, octave equivalents there. Within this key of C major, there are certain harmonic gestures, certain chord progressions that give us a sense of being in this home key. And I'm just kind of arbitrarily choosing C major because it's easy to play on both a regular piano and a virtual one. And it's helpful to think in terms of this home key, what we also know as a tonic. Some of these gestures are cadences, punctuation marks that help give a piece its form. The most important of these cadences in establishing a tonic or a home key is the authentic cadence. All right, sounds like this. Hold on, that's a tritone. And then, so you have tension. Doesn't allow for me to play all the notes at the same time, but hopefully you can hear that little bit of that. So listen to that tension that's set up, both by this interval, and also this interval, which it doesn't allow me to play at the same time, but you can imagine. And all three of those at the same time, all three of those notes make that kind of very tense sounding, and then it's released as soon as you get to that tonic. Yay. So, doesn't that return to the tonic after the tense dominant chord feel so right? Like you've just returned home after a long day. This is the basis of much Western music, this cadence. Other cadences exist which provide a kind of weaker sense of tonality, or a tonal or harmonic center. One is something called a plagal cadence. There's very often found in pop and folk music. And then there is a blues cadence derived from the 12-bar blues form, which ends with a motion 5-4-1. I'll show these in a second. The authentic cadence, though, that one we just heard, this 5-1, as we call it, reigns supreme. So, let's get to terrapin, because that's really what's exciting, isn't it? And this is just a summary of those cadences.
What was the first one was the dominant?
Yeah, this first one here, so that I played was this authentic, the authentic cadence where you go from the five to the ones. That's that really tension establishing and then tension releasing. And my example here, if we're in C, is this G to C. Then there's this one which is called plagal cadence. This is also known as the amen cadence, because if you've ever heard most church music, it's the amen, and it's that kind of that feel. It's not as strong as establishing this tonic, but it works. It's used a lot in pop music. And then, of course, the blues cadence, as I'm calling it, this 5-4-1, or GFC. And for any of you who play guitar, you'll be very aware of this. Okay. So let's listen to the beginning of Terrapin. In the background, we hear Jerry lightly strumming the introductory chords. He's playing an F major chord, F, A, C, and then he alternates that with another chord, F, B, C. There's one problem here. B is not a member of the F major scale. It's one of those chromatic tones that I was saying before. It doesn't belong. In fact, it forms the dreaded dissonant interval of the tritone. This is not the best way to start a piece of music, this avoidance of a very clear tonal center. We kind of think we're in F major, but we're not really sure. We don't have that nice tension to releasing that we would find usually. The opening Jerry lick, which starts the song proper, is a rising arpeggiation of tones in the F major scale that I've shown right here. Although they are not members of that F major chord. A very common first gesture in music is to hear the opening chord at the very beginning. Jerry gives us a series of notes that don't really make up a chord at all. C, D, A, D, C. As you can see there. So, an F major chord is defined by three notes. These would be F, A, and C. So if we think of these notes that open the song as scale degrees, well, if we're in F major, we don't have a 1 there at all, you can see. But if we're in C major, we do have a 1, but we don't have that 3 and the 5. What you want to get a full chord is a 1, a 3, and a 5, and we don't have any of that here. And it's that all-important 1 that would give the F major chord its really distinctive character and its identity. We can already see that the harmonic area of this opening riff is ambiguous. It can be heard as either C major or F major, but neither are really good answers. Further obfuscating our senses is that the weird chord with that tritone in it, the one I was talking about before, the other chord of the opening, it resolves ever so nicely to C. So it actually kind of suggests C major more than F major. And when we listen to this, you can kind of tell. There's really no sense that you've found a strong major chord at the beginning. It's kind of maybe. Phil gives
notes?
A.
Where are those notes? Melody?
The first note of the melody, let is B. Yeah, which causes more problems. Yeah. No, this is da 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 dum right here.
Oh, Bob's playing that.
Oh.
Yeah, it is Bob.
Oh, okay. My bad. Yes, you're right, it is.
Anything that sounds good is by Jerry.
I'm such a noob. Okay. Anyways. And here's the thing. Of course, Phil gives us absolutely nothing to go on. In fact, he gives us both C's and F's on the downbeats of each bar. So thanks, Phil. One further interpretation of this opening suggested by David Malviny, and it's something that I buy in this, is that this is not tonal, but rather modal. And anyone who has heard Graham Boone's talk or has read his article on Darkstar kind of understands that the idea of the mode is really at the heart of a lot of Grateful Dead's music. Somebody once said, and this is a quote I'm referencing from memory, so it's not, I don't remember exactly, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, all Jerry Garcia ever did was play up and down the Mixolydian mode. And then the deadhead responded, said, yes, but it took someone like Jerry to know when to go up and when to go down. Anyways, so in other words, rather than being based on chords and a concept of a tonic home key, the notes and chords come from a different set of organizing principles, the mode of F Lydian, which sounds kind of like this. Hold on. Doesn't really sound like the major scale that we heard before. Okay, so there's our mode. And of course, as you mentioned, Kay, the opening note of the entire lyrics is let my inspiration, right there. So, and that causes that problem, of course, again.
But it's a G chord.
It's a G chord, right. It sounds nice when it starts, right there. I'm getting into that, though. Don't worry, dude. Okay, so I gotta zoom through all my previous stuff here. Okay, so now we get into the song proper here. When the verse starts, we have yet another framework in which to observe the elusive tonal scheme of this song and the suggested modality. The verse chords shown here can be interpreted in our previous suggested key area of F major. Remember, it's certain cadences that will establish a tonal center, and which cadences do we find here? Well, we kind of feel F moving to C as the closing gesture of the verse. That would be a half cadence, which doesn't really do anything for us as far as giving us a good sense of where we are in a harmonic scheme, suggesting an unfinished or unreached tonal release of tension. Or do we hear it the other way around? Does that kind of emphasis fall on F? And we actually have an authentic cadence. Well, you be the judge. And I put the lyrics up there so you can follow along with it, but is the downbeat that we feel on the F chord, tail is, or is it on done, or forsake me? We feel... Well, it actually seems like we have this more sense of something that might be in C major. These plagal cadences that we were talking about before, and that blues cadence that you have right there. That's that feeling of forsake me till my tale is told and done. Ah, okay. And of course, the fact that it comes on the word done doesn't hurt either. The strophic nature, which means that the same music is repeated for each verse while the lyrics change, just reinforces this harmonic ambiguity. Because there's no change and we keep hearing those vague harmonies over and over again. Now we move into the bridge and we find a series of what seem to be harmonic area establishing motions. The F Lydian areas, the whole lady with a fan verses and everything, move to a strong B major. And we get a big, nice chord, right? And then that's followed by a strong E minor, another really good chord. And these two are related in that you can see that these are both kind of 5-1s, that this B major going to E is that same 5-1 cadence that we were talking about before. This suggests that E minor might be a tonal center. And were we to follow this trail through a circle of fifths, basically, keep on progressing, we might expect A next, which is what I crossed out here. Although I guess I made it too thick and you can't see that there's an A under there. But instead, C7 shows up out of nowhere with its prominent B flat, a new note that had not been heard at all once throughout the entire song, and this moment is very sonically unexpected. So this is the Lydian area still up here. Thank you. tension, release, and then we get. Okay. Oh yeah, of course, of course. But it's harmonically unexpected. It's not something we would expect at all. And it gives this kind of like a jazzy feel all of a sudden. Now, the oscillation that we finally get over the Since the End Is Never Told lyric goes between F major 7 and C9, and this once again suggests a strong F tonality. Although, it's more jazz than the classical or folk or pop tradition. But once again, that tonal center is subverted, and it heads to E major. So it goes right from there into the E major, the overbought and sold. So now we think, okay, we're happily in a new key of E major. And this is reinforced by the fact that we hear what I call the sunrise motif. So we're in E major now. Hear that sunrise riff. Don't worry. Are we now in E major? It would seem so, until Jerry enters with the new lyrics. And we realize that this E major, which felt like it was home, right, is actually the five of A major. So that it was actually not home at all. And we now have an authentic cadence in A on the word inspiration. We have the most powerful cadence in the entire song right there. It's probably why this moment is so awesome. I'm gonna resolve that for all you know. Wow. And now we're in A major. The most tonally stable part of the entire song. Very far from the F Lydian that we started in, of course. This dovetails very nicely with the lyrics as well, since we are now finally getting to Terrapin. It seems that we have indeed gotten there wherever there may be. Now we hear about a rare and different tune, and this EA cadence here that we've been hearing is interrupted by D, so you hear this D instead, and it kind of throws you off a little, but it still sounds right because the pop music cadence, that 5-4-1 or that blues cadence, is still in there, and that sounds okay to us. Okay.
Why are you leaving out the passing chords in the augmented?
Hmm?
You're leaving out all those nice passing chords in the augmented chord.
They're just diminutions. Hey, I'm not arguing with you at all, but I'm looking at it from back here, and those happen down there. That's the good stuff. This is the annoying stuff. Okay. Yet once we're told that we will in fact be there soon, the resolution is totally avoided, delayed, indeed totally unresolved. The A that we had become so comfortable to is gone, and we come rollicking into D and a guitar riff based around A minor. How did we get here? And where is here? We've moved. Yeah. Let me get just that progression in there. 4-1. And then we get another type of cadence, but still very D, A. And then we go back to E major. And we think we're gonna get A, but we don't. It just keeps going with E. And then minor. And we have this really minor feeling thing here. Okay. we know, this is how the song ends, right? Repeated many times, of course, awesome, but still. So this is where we kind of went throughout the whole piece. We start in these F Lydian, then we go through B, we think it's gonna be E, we come in through here, then we find out this A major, and we have this progression throughout the whole Inspiration Move Me Brightly section, and that E, that last E, before it goes to A, it's continued, and we end up in D, and it sounds like A minor. So, my point in all of this, and this is where I'm just gonna kind of riff on this a little bit, is that the harmonic ambiguity, the tonal ambiguity of Terrapin Station is directly related to the kind of representative, the geographic ambiguity in this, in the lyrics, and that we now see in the music is represented by this harmony. I think that this has a lot to do with the fact that we all feel we have our own concept of where Terrapin is, but it's probably different for all of us as well. I think this is maybe why a place called Terrapin Station in San Francisco, where we could all go and relive the dead experience, other than all the obvious downfalls of why that didn't end up materializing, maybe that's why that never materialized. Maybe they should have called it something other than Terrapin Station, called it Shakedown Street or something. And although that would have had its own problems, I know. And yeah, broke down. Seriously. And I just want to conclude by reading this quote from Mary Eisenhart's introduction to her interview with Robert Hunter. And she's talking about the New Year's 81-82. Picture, if you will, 8,000 people, many still soaking wet, jammed into the Oakland Auditorium. Listen to the band blazing, Garcia belting out the lyrics with exceptional fervor and the rumble. By the time he gets to the Counting Stars by Candlelight line, 8,000 people are roaring along, matching him syllable for syllable through the crickets and cicadas, the end and the beginning, the train putting its brakes on, and the whistle screaming, Terrapin. Not one of us has ever laid eyes on Terrapin Station, and we'd be hard-pressed to define exactly what it was. But for that moment, there was not the slightest doubt that if we listened hard enough, sang loud enough, and just hung in there, we could collectively lift that decrepit hall off its foundations and get there. Yay. My last little thing is that we used to always drive by this cabin that looked just like that. Like, just like that without the Dancing Terrapins, but little cabin with railways in front, and I was convinced. I said, there it is, that's Terrapin Station. So I just provided these little visuals here for you as well.
So Terrapin was originally a Rolling Stone cover?
Yes, yes, yes. You've been listening, good, good. So let's switch it up.
Next year, you're going to do Bow Down to Washington.
David, I'll tell you all.
Just on passing chords. He's got to get the big passing chords.
But that's what makes the song so good. Yeah. 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 Heather knows what those are. That's Shankar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure.
It's probably background. There's foreground.
Yeah.
We have a little time to converse.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I'll tell you all about it. I'll tell you all about Shankar. You'll love it. It's great.
Why did you choose such an early version?
I like that one. That's the first version ever.
That's
the Swing Auditorium, 22697.
I have that on a tape that sounds so different.
It wasn't quite finished.
Well, they finished it. I just didn't finish it.
The
song.
One of the passages that you played, the chords weren't quite there.
Yeah, the part that you were complaining about. Yes.
You said 97. You mean 77?
No, 77.
Yes. Oh, I said 97.
Yeah, you're young.
There was no.
I can't say that yet.
Well, I don't think so. Yeah.
He was born in 1981.
81, yeah. Oh, you know what? No, I think it should.
He has to recognize it, but he did before.